You to take your Bibles and turn to 1 Timothy, the fourth chapter, and in verse 12, this evening I wanted to take some time and look at a very important verse to me. That has been very encouraging to me over the last year as I've been working in this aspect of being a preacher. And in 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 12, there we go. 1 Timothy 4 and in the 12th verse, Paul gives Timothy, who's a younger man, some insight. And in 1 Timothy 4, read with me, beginning in verse 12. It says, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by the prophecy, with the laying on of the hands of the eldership. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue with them, for in so doing, you will save both yourself and those who hear you." About a year and a half ago, I made the decision, and I brought it before Maria. We weren't married yet. We were just engaged. And I told her that I wanted to preach, that it was something that I was going to do, and I wanted her support, and she was willing and able to support me in that effort. And being that we were deciding that we were planning our future, we decided to look for the best option for me to start preaching. And we quickly came across a congregation that was looking and searching for someone to enter into their preacher training program, someone to come in and work with an evangelist to be taught on how to be an effective preacher. And upon meeting with this congregation and studying with them and talking with them for a very brief period of time, they came to the conclusion that I was too young to participate in their preacher training program. And as you can imagine, me being not an experienced preacher at that time, and I'm still not experienced, you can imagine this being something that was very hard for me, something that was very discouraging, something that was very difficult for me a very hard pill to swallow, as you can imagine. But this verse here in 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 12 was shown to me by later an older preacher, one who is more advanced, one who understood this verse and brought it to my attention. And the comfort that it gave me, the importance that we can see in that, is something that I really would like to take some time and look at the value behind this text, because it's something that is important to me. And we remember Timothy was a young man. Timothy was one who was young. There we go. Sorry about that. But we see that there are two things that are commanded here by Paul in this text, in this very first verse. The first one, let no man despise thy youth. And when you think about that statement, let no one despise thy youth. When you think about the word despise, as we oftentimes use it today, it's one of to look down upon, to even hate at that time, in that realm. It can be used in that manner. And if you think about it, it doesn't really make sense. That statement is not something that makes sense. How could someone be hated for being young? Every person that lived in this earth was young at one point. But if you look at the meaning of that word, at the value behind it, it's talking about how you can think little of. And Paul is giving the instruction to Timothy to let no one think little of you because you're young, that you're able to be an example, and that you're to be an example to them that are believers. And then he lists various ways in which he can do that. And I think that for us to be an example, I know there's many men here who do preach at time to time, that they bring lessons, so I thought this would be a profitable lesson to think about how Timothy, not only as a young man, as a young Christian, but as a teacher, had certain responsibilities that he was to meet. And there are definitely principles that we can see speaking to that. In James, the third chapter, and in verse 1, if you would read with me there, in James 3 and in verse 1. James, the third chapter, and in the first verse. It reads here, "My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment." Now, this is speaking to the obligation that those men that desire to be teachers, that want to bring people to the lost, to study study God's word with them to in a more extensive detail, that there is an obligation binded with that, that the teaching in which we need to put forth is something that needs to be strong, something that needs to have conviction. And when we look at the context of the third chapter of James, we know that it's speaking of our tongue and the dangers that can be brought about by our tongue if it's not something that is controlled. He's showing that a teacher's very well accountable for what he says, that he's responsible for the damage that he can do by the things that he says. And there's a good lesson that we can take from that. In Romans, the second chapter, and in verse 17, Paul speaks to this idea as well. The church at Rome was struggling with different Jews who had once, or in this second chapter, he's addressing Jews who have later tried to revert back to being Judaizing teachers to an extent. And in Romans 2 and in verse 17, it reads here, "Indeed, you are called a Jew, and rest on the law, and make your boast in God, and know his will, and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and now and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. You therefore, who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal?" We see what he's getting at here, how a teacher needs to have a firm understanding of that which he is teaching in order to be able to present it in a way that makes sense to those that hear him. And there needs to be a value behind that. There's a lot of preachers, sadly, that we see out in the world, and I'm taking Dennis Scroggins' statement on this, that don't know if Jesus was crucified on Calvary's cross or if he was shot at Bunker Hill. That they don't have a clue in which what happened in the Bible. But yet they're very good motivational speakers. They're able to get up and present a very witty lesson, one that feels good to the ears, one that is encouraging to hear day in and day out, and they can do it very well. But they're a motivational speaker. They're not a preacher. They're not one who wants to save souls. In the same way how the Jews in this text were claiming, oh, look at us, we know the way, we know how we can be saved. But yet they're binding Old Testament principles, Old Testament practices that had since been done away with, and they did not know the clear way to serve God fully. The knowledge was placed in that wrong place. Today, people place knowledge on a lot of different things that are not focused on God. We see our schools, our schooling system places a strong emphasis on looking at the basis of science, looking at the basis of social studies and how people interact. But the Bible is our guidelines, and we need to turn to those. It's not wrong to indulge ourselves in that knowledge to better ourselves so that we can see how people tick, but the Bible is our ultimate guideline, our ultimate basis for how we should live every day of our lives. But turn to Hebrews, the 5th chapter, and in verse 12, Hebrews, the 5th chapter, and in the 12th verse, the Hebrew writer as well speaks to this idea. In Hebrews 5 and in verse 12, Hebrews 5 and in the 12th verse, it reads here, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food." So we see a very interesting idea. If you remember back to James 3 and verse 1, that verse that we read just a few minutes ago, how did that verse start off? Did it not say, "Let not many of you become teachers"? And here the Hebrew writer is saying, "Well, for though by this time you ought to be teachers." So which is it? Is the Hebrew writer right, or is it James? Which one are we going to listen to? Are we supposed to be teaching, or are we supposed to be not teaching? Well, if you think about it, these passages are rather not conflicting, but rather they're blending well together, if you can look at it in that way. In James, the 3rd chapter, he's speaking of that sobering responsibility that comes to those who are willing to preach the gospel of Christ, that they need to not teach rashly, but they need to have careful consideration of every word that comes out of their mouth. They need to understand what it is that they are preaching. And here the Hebrew writer is recognizing that teaching is those for those who are mature in the faith. And it's a rebuke of them for not maturing. He's saying by this time you need to be teaching. You need to understand these things. You need to be able to spread them to those that you come in contact with. And I think there's a very good lesson for us. We see a lot of people who go living their lives throughout the church and they get to being 75 years old and yet they still don't know how someone is saved. They still don't understand the gospel plan of salvation fully. They don't understand the ideas of grace, the ideas of love, the ideas of obedience that come along with that. These passages complement each other. They're not contradictory. But how can we take time? How can we show these to be an example in our lives? Well, we see that our lives must be consistent with that which we are teaching. In 1 Timothy 4, and in verse 12. What was the idea that Paul spoke there? Or 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 16. I've been putting the wrong verses all day. In 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 16, Paul says to Timothy, "Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in so doing this, you will save both yourself and those who hear you." We need to live the life. Not just talk the talk, but walk the walk. It's a very cliche statement, but that's exactly the idea that we're getting at here, that we're trying to show. Why is it so many times that when a preacher or an elder or someone who's involved in sin and they come forward, they make that public confession and they're very sorrowful for it? Why is it a lot of times that when that does take place, that preacher, that elder needs to step down or move away? Is it not because they've lost their effectiveness? Because they don't practice what they preach? They've become hypocritical? That people are not going to listen to them because they didn't listen to themselves? There's a lesson that we can gain from this. There's something that we can reach from practicing this thing that we call the Christian life in our own lives, to where it's something that we truly believe, that we are truly willing to hold on to and apply in our day-to-day lives. We see that unseemly behavior causes us as Christians to lose our influence and God to be blasphemed. Notice back in Romans the second chapter, where we were just a few moments ago, the following verses to those ideas that we said about the Jews who were bringing those back to or trying to attempt to reach the Gentiles and tell them that they needed to abide in Old Testament laws. In Romans, the second chapter, and in verse 23. Romans 2, and in verse 23. It reads here, "For you who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written." Maria and I heard a story not too long ago from some very close friends of ours, and they were telling us how they were trying to reach her mother, who's not a Christian. And they had been inviting her to come to services. They had been inviting her to come and attend with them. And one Sunday evening, she finally accepted that invitation. She finally decided that it would be time for her to come to services with them. And she came, and after services, an elder and another couple from the congregation, they invited them to go out to dinner. So the mother, and then their children, and then the elder and their couple, they all went together to dinner after services. And while they were sitting around the table, the elder and his wife and this other couple began talking about a prestigious alcohol club that they were involved in. And mind you, this woman's mother is not a Christian. And later after dinner, she made the statement to her children, "If I knew that the church was all based about this, if I knew that this was being a Christian was all about, I would have became a Christian a long time ago." And you can see in the same way how not only in this old law was the word of God blasphemed because of the Jews' attitude, but today the church is blasphemed because of part-time Christians, because of people who truly don't believe that this is an important thing to do in our lives, that being a Christian is something that is easy, but it's not. It's a full-time gig. It's something that is very difficult. And you can see how someone's influence, how their example can be tainted because of their failure to practice these things in their lives. If you look in Titus, the second chapter, we see sort of the flip side to that coin of the positivity that can be brought about by a strong example, by an example that is willing to follow God, to serve God fully. In Titus, the second chapter, and in verse 6, Paul tells Titus, a young man, and he says, "Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, and incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say to you." This is really that flip side of the coin, how powerful a good influence means, how valuable it is. There's a lot of Christians that when they are involved in sin, they try and play like Adam and Eve, where no one will find out about my sins. God's not going to find out even. But that's not the case. But why is it? Why do we take that mindset and run with it sometimes? Why is it that we are ashamed of our sin? Is it because we're afraid of who might find out? Is it because we're afraid of what it might do to our reputation, that we might not be seen as such a strong Christian anymore? Titus here is a young man, and Paul's writing to him, telling him that he's able to exhort the other young men to good works. He's able to exhort the older men to rise up, to realize that they need to be elders, that they can be positive examples to them that believe. And there's something to be gained from that. There is power and influence to be had even while we are younger. And that extends to being younger in the faith even as well. There's something that we can gain from this. There's an application that we can see. And I think that the power of a good example commands respect in spite of age or youth. The modern concept that we have today of youth is wrong a lot of times. It's oftentimes assumed that the younger members of the Church of Christ, especially this generation that is kind of rising up, desires more institutional-based ideas, whether it comes to the social gospel or acceptance of social drinking or feel-good lessons that are something that are enjoyable. And while that may be true to some extent, I would like to say that there's probably just as many on the other side that want good, strong, Bible-based preaching, that we want to follow God, that we want to seek and serve Him fully. The best teachers and the hardest workers, regardless of their age, are those who are young at heart, who are willing to work for the Lord no matter how old they are, no matter how young or no matter how advanced in age they are. Yes, we do need more preachers. Yes, we do need more people that are going to serve God day in and day out, but there's a value that we can see here, that there are things that we can do. There are ways in which we can be a good example to those that are around us. My grandfather, Tom Baker, used to say, "Tell me the character of the young, and I'll tell you the character of the next generation of the church." And if you think about it, shouldn't we want that? If you were to hand out a bunch of note cards to members of the church and you said, "Tell me what you think about the coming in generation," wouldn't you want every one of those responses to be something that said something good about that coming generation? It is the future of the church, however, and we need to think of it as such, that it should be something that we would want to continue, that we would want to be strong in serving God. I think that our influence does come from consistency in our religious lives, and our text shows us some areas there in 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 12 on how we can do that. Do you remember the list that we saw there? The first one being that how we can be a good example in our speech. If you look in Matthew, the 12th chapter, and in verse 34. Matthew 12, and in the 34th verse. Notice what Jesus says here. Matthew 12, beginning in verse 34. It reads here, "Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. And an evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, that they will give an account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." There's sadly a lot of members in the church that act just like the Pharisees did here in this verse, how they were that Christian with that corrupt heart, and how they only spoke corrupt things. There's a lot of Christians that we can see doing that, sadly. It's something that is very discouraging when we do see. But you remember how Jesus spoke about the Pharisees, how outwardly they were appeared good, but inwardly they were like whitewashed tombs. In Ephesians 4 and in verse 29, Paul spoke to this idea of corrupt language and the effect that it can have on the Christian if it's not dealt with, if it is not something that is put away. In Ephesians 4 and in verse 29, read what Paul tells the church at Ephesus there. In Ephesians 4, beginning in the 29th verse, it says, "Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good and necessary for edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers." Now drop down to chapter 5 of Ephesians, and beginning in the first verse. "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children, and walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks." He's saying that we may have been involved in these in the past. We may have been something that we partook in our day-to-day lives. But we need to put those things away. We cannot be involved with them anymore if we want to still maintain a good example. You think about it in this way. If you know someone who is working out and they're exercising, or maybe they're doing some yard work outside and they begin to be very sweaty and their clothes are just very dirty and filthy. And as soon as they get into their house, in the privacy of their home, they change those clothes and they'll throw them on the floor. For the sake of the analogy, that's where they'll leave them. But say they come back in a few days, they can't get those clothes and put them back on. They're still dirty. They're still filthy. And in the same way, that's what Paul's message to the church at Ephesus was about. He's saying you can't go back to those things. They're still the same way that they were. They haven't changed. They're still coarse jesting. They're still things that are not fitting for us as a Christian. And that's the message that he's trying to get across, that we can't go back to those ways and still be fit for the kingdom of heaven in terms of our example. With our speech, Paul tells us, and he told Timothy at the church of Ephesus as he was working there, that we are able to do what is necessary to give thanks, to be encouraging to our brethren. What was it I said that he said there? That was necessary for edification. That we're able to build up our brethren on the same time as you flip that coin. You think about it. We're able to do just as much damage with our tongue, with the things that we say as well. We see also, Paul mentions the idea of our manner of life. In Ephesians 4 and in verse 1, Ephesians, the fourth chapter, and in the first verse. Notice what Paul tells the church at Ephesus here. He says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. We see that word beseech there. Do you remember another verse in our New Testament that renders that verse? Is it not Romans 12 and in verse 1 where he said, I beseech you therefore by the mercies of God to present yourselves a living sacrifice. And when you think about that word beseech, it's a pretty interesting term, one that we don't necessarily use a lot of times. When you do think about the meaning of it, it's something along the lines of a plea, of me asking you to do something. But really, if you look at the language that is used by Paul in both of those verses, it's really in the form of a command. It's a direct command of what he is trying to say how we need to live our lives. That we need, he's commanding them, I therefore, by the prisoner of the Lord, command you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. How can we do that if our manner of life that we're living every day is not up to par with how the Bible would tell us to? It's something we need to think about. In 2 Timothy 2 and in verse 22, we see also Paul getting at this idea. 2 Timothy 2 and in verse 22, it reads here, flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. When you ask I've seen a lot of people ask the questions, where do we find the best sermons? Where can we find the best ideas of something to preach on that will really be something that is edifying for a congregation to hear? Well, the best examples in our everyday lives. The best examples, the best illustrations, the best things that we can think of on the best way to let our light shine is by applying these things that we see in our Bible into our everyday lives, to where people can tell that we are a Christian, that we stand for something different than the morals that the world would have us to. That's the application that we can gain from here. But how can we do that if we're not living correctly? We see that by love as well. Paul mentioned this to Timothy, that he's able to be a good example. And in Matthew 22, verse 34, read what Jesus says here in Matthew 22 and in the 34th verse about how love is a way in which he is able to show himself to be a good example to them that believe. In Matthew 22 and in the 34th verse, it reads here, but when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, saying, Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and the great commandment. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. We see, if you remember how he's telling us we need to love those that are around us. That's a way in which we can show that love. In Galatians 6, if you remember in verse 9, it tells the church of Galatia to love especially those of the household of faith, those that are believers, that we need to hold on to those ideas. And we think about it, denominational groups that are out in the world express ideas of love. They preach on them probably nearly every Sunday. And that's a really good thing that they focus on them, but that's the only thing that they focus on. It's the only thing that you can hear them preach on from time to time. But if you look in 1 John, or we remember in John 14 and verse 15, what did Jesus say there? In John 14 and in verse 15, notice here a way in which we can show our love to God. In John 14 and verse 15, a verse we all very well know. If you love me, do what? Keep my commandments. Simple enough to understand, but carrying that out is a very different matter, something that is a little bit difficult at times, I would say. If you think about it, if you're working a secular job and your boss assigns you a project with the due date and you need to have it completed by that time, but you just decide that you're not going to do it, that it's not something that you're going to waste your time on, well, that shows that you don't really love your job that much, that that's not something that is a priority to you, that you care about a lot. Otherwise, you would do what it takes to complete that project to show that you care about your involvement at that company. And if you think about it, if you replace the idea of a workplace with our Christian life, we have commandments. We have assigned projects, if you will, that we are to carry out, that we are to get done every day. But yet, do we do them? How important is our example? How much do you care about Christ? How important is this walk of faith that we claim to be living to us? It's a good thing to think about. A good way in which we can show that we love God or Jesus by keeping His commandments is seen in our actions and in 1 John 3 and in verse 16. 1 John 3 and in verse 16. 1 John 3 and in the 16th verse. Read here, it says, by this we know love, because He laid down His life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Our example can speak for itself. That's a way in which we can show that we truly do love God because we truly do love our brethren, that we're going to help them if it comes down to that. And when it came down to that, when I was turned down from that training program, this was something that was hard for me because I was discouraged at that time. I was turned down. I was feeling sad. When you say a lot of things about how we can show our love to people versus doing them, versus carrying them out, there's a very big difference there. We need to act in a manner that would demonstrate our love for our brethren, our love for our neighbor. When is the last time that we visited those that are shut in? When is the last time that we asked if we could bring a meal to someone who's maybe sick or maybe not doing well physically? There are ways that we can help our members. We just need to look for them in the right time. We need to ask how we can help out our other members. We see also, our faith is a way in which we can show ourselves to be a good example. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and in the 6th verse, read what the Hebrew writer states regarding this idea of faith. In Hebrews 11 and in verse 6, we know the 11th chapter of Hebrews to often be times referred to as that hall of faith, where we see so many different individuals that we can read of from the Old Testament, where their faith was something that shook mountains, if you will. Their faith was a monument for us, that we could see how they trusted in God. And in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and in verse 6, it says, but without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. It is impossible to please God without faith. Well, what is faith? Well, verse 1 of Hebrews 11 tells us that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Our belief in our Christian faith is entirely based on belief, based on a hope. We believe that Jesus is the Son of God. That's something that takes faith. That is something that we need to hold to. In 2 Timothy 4 and in verse 6, read what Paul tells Timothy regarding that faith. In 2 Timothy 4 and in verse 6, Paul, toward the end of his life, he's leaving these closing remarks to Timothy. And in 2 Timothy 4 and in the 6th verse, it says, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day. And not to me only, but to all those who have loved His appearing. That word, faith, there is translated as the Greek word pistis. And it's speaking of relating to God. And when you think about it, Paul upheld the conviction of who God was from the time of his conversion to the end of his life. It is something that we don't have record of him falling in any other way. He upheld that conviction of who God was, of who Jesus was, of the promises by which our faith is based upon, is founded upon. And it's something that he held to, pressing toward what? In verse 8, what did it tell us? That crown of righteousness, that eternal life that we're so always seeking. That is our goal. That's the reason that we are living as a Christian should. And in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, and in verse 1, notice here, Hebrews 12, and in verse 1, the Hebrew writer speaking here, he says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our," what? "Of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." When it says that great cloud of witnesses, who's that speaking of? That's speaking of those that were in chapter 11 that were mentioned in that hall of faith. Those great accounts that we can look back and we can see, wow, their faith was something that was something special. When he says here in verse at the end of verse 2 where it says that Jesus despising the shame, is that saying that Jesus hated to be crucified, that it was something that he really hated to do? I don't necessarily think so. I think it's speaking to that same use of despising that we saw in 1 Timothy 4:12, saying that he thought little of it, that it was something that did not mean much to him because he knew it was for a greater cause. That cause being that it would provide eternal life for us because who promised it? Because God, his Father, promised it. And he had a faith in God that he would deliver it, that he would hold up his end of the bargain. And I wholeheartedly believe that that's the situation in which we have found ourselves today, those of us that are members of that church. We also see two more ideas before we wrap up, that purity is one that is mentioned by Paul. And when we think about in Colossians 3 and in verse 2, if you turn there, this aspect of purity is speaking of the idea of without carnal contamination. And he's being told by Paul, quite frankly, to live soberly, to live sober-minded. And we remember that church at Corinth. Paul wrote those first two letters to them, especially as they were too carnally minded to understand Paul. We remember how there was a man with his father's wife, and they were not able to remove him from them. We remember how they were placing a strong emphasis on spiritual gifts, on the laying on of hands and those things, how they were too carnal-minded to focus upon our faith, that there's something more than this life. And if you think about it, in Colossians 3 and verse 2, it gives us very clear instruction on how we can do this, and I don't want to spend too much time on it because I can't be more clear than this. Colossians 3 and in verse 2, set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth. That's our basis for how we can live a pure life, to where we are always focusing on Jesus, to where we are going to focus on him 100% of the time, and we're not going to give our attention anywhere else. Our prize, our crown of life can be lost if we do lose that attention, if we feel ourselves sinking, if you will. We also see that by spirit, in Philippians 1 and in verse 27, Philippians, in the first chapter, and in the 27th verse. Philippians 1 and in verse 27, it reads here, "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." Paul is telling Timothy to hold fast to that doctrine. We notice that in verse 16. But he's being commended. He's commending Timothy and Titus for holding true to the gospel even later on. It's something that we can take note of. To be standing in one spirit, to where they were able to unify those congregations that they were at by the power that was to be had by their good examples. How they were able to lead the congregation in the right direction. We also see Jesus spoke on the power of our influence in Matthew the 5th chapter and in verse 13. If you'd turn there. And notice what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount regarding this idea. Matthew, the 5th chapter, and in the 13th verse. Notice here. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 13, Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. We see a little bit about salt as well as its preserving quality. If we aren't showing our lives to be different than the world, then we're like that salt that loses its flavor, that it's then profitable for nothing. I remember taking a field trip a few years back when we still lived in Arizona up north, and we got to go around a Navajo tribe. And one of these homes, they had a burrow in the home that was dug out. And it went deep down, and during the winter, that it would freeze up in those high elevations. And they would store meat from their kills in there, and they would pour salt over it to preserve it. And it's a really good illustration of how salt, if it's properly around everything, that Jesus is telling us that we're the salt of the earth, that we have the ability to preserve those that we are around. And how can we do that? By our example. By them seeing that we live according to the beat of a different drum, if you will. That we're living according to God, according to the gospel of Jesus Christ, and not according to the principles that the world might tell us that we need to live. He also speaks here about how light. It can't be hidden, so it must be something that is good. That Greek word there for you are the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill that cannot be hidden. That Greek word for light is the word phos. And there's three different uses that we see throughout the New Testament for this word phos. And the first one being the appearance when angels ascend or descend to earth. I don't think it's speaking about that here. The second one being that is light that is given off by a torch, a lampstand, or a star that is seen in the night. I don't necessarily think it's speaking about that one either. And the third one is the reason why. The third one is the definition being how God's light, that it has an extremely pure and extremely brilliant quality. That which is exposed to the view of all publicly. And I think that's the way in which we, our lives need to be guided. To where we understand that we are a light. That we are an example to not only them that believe, but everyone around us. Why? Because Jesus said so here. That we are to do our best to preserve them. And the ultimate purpose of this good example is seen in verse 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. We need to ask ourselves, are we ashamed of being a Christian? Are we ashamed of taking up our cross day in and day out and following Jesus? Is it something that is important to us? We sing the song with our children as we're teaching them, you know, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. We can sing that song day in and day out with our children, but if we are not showing that in our lives, if they don't see that we're truly living as a Christian should, it means nothing. And those fears that we may have about the coming younger generations in the Church of Christ are a very real thing. If they don't see that that we are standing for the truth, that there is a reason in which we are diligently serving God, our Father in heaven. We also see in Solomon provides some example regarding this. In Ecclesiastes 11, beginning in verse 9, if you would turn there with me. Ecclesiastes 11, beginning in the 9th verse. Solomon says here, he says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come, and the years draw near when you say, 'I have no pleasure in them.'" There's three important things that he states to those that are younger in age here. And this is a verse that we use a lot of times before students go back to school, whether it be going back to college or things like that, that they need to look to them. And these older members, you know, he tells us to rejoice, to remove, and to remember. There's a lot of older members, I'm sure, in the church. I've seen them that might go back and say, "Man, I really wish I had gotten into the habit when I was younger of reading my Bible every day. I really wish I had started the practice of praying every day, of just taking time to dedicate a little bit of my time of the day to God." Well, you can be that example to them that are younger now. And those of us that are younger, we see that young people, are we living in these? Solomon says here to live life, to be happy, to rejoice. But remember, God sees everything. There's nothing that slips by him. I know I carried out that first part of that in my life and while I was in high school probably a little too much. I didn't remember that God was always watching. But with that ultimate purpose, that ultimate fate that we can see of all, is in verses 13 and 14. It says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter Ecclesiastes 12 and in verse 13, pardon me. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. For this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. There's a reason that we need to remember that. It's because all are subject to God's judgment. There's nothing that is going to escape Him. We need to fear God. We need to keep His commandments because He's the creator of the whole earth. He is that righteous judge that we will all stand before on that last day. But you may ask, well, when is the time? When is the time that we need to be abiding in these different things? Well, now is the time. I'm getting off track. But in 2 Corinthians 6 and in verse 1, one last verse before we wrap up this evening. 2 Corinthians 6 and in the first verse. Notice what Paul says here. 2 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 1, it says, "We then, as workers together with Him, also plead with you now to receive the grace of God, not to receive the grace of God in vain. For He says, 'In an acceptable time I have heard you, and in the day of salvation I have helped you.'" But notice here, "Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation." Now is that time for us to apply these principles into our example, for us to let our light shine to those that may be able to see us, that we may be able to show them that maybe that path that they're on is not correct. A lot of times when we're younger, we think that we are able to run through walls, that we can take a bullet and stand up and be fine. And while that may be true for some of us, it's not. Our life is very brief. Our life is just for a moment, like a vapor that vanishes away. And we don't know when that judgment day will come. Now is the important time for us to be living out our example so that we can show them that believe that we are all in this together, that we are unified in one spirit and we're going to serve God together. That's the idea that we're trying to get across here. It's a very hard road being a Christian, but it is something that is very rewarding. Are you a Christian this evening? Don't waste your life. We are able to use every chance of it for our cause to bring more souls back to the way. That list that Paul gave Timothy there in 1 Timothy 4 and in verse 12, it's not something that is only for preachers. It's not something only for those that are young, something only for those that are wanting to preach the gospel. It's for all Christians. It's for principles that we all need to adhere to. And we can struggle with these different things at times, but now's the time for us to rise to the occasion, to show that we are going to live our example out. Whether it's the older members that may have been that good example to us that led us back to the right. Sadly, they're not going to be here forever. And now is the time where those of us that are younger are able to step in, are able to make that change so that they can see that there is something good left in the Church of Christ, that it's not going to go off on those other ways. Are you subject to the invitation tonight? Do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that He died on Calvary's cruel cross, and that He was raised again on that third day? If you're willing to make that bold confession before us this evening and you're ready to live a life, live an example out in your life that would be one pleasing to God and pleasing to those that are around you, to where we would be able to fellowship with you. We would love to baptize you and to work with you here at this local work, I'm sure. If you have already been a Christian, but your example has been something that has been rather contrary to the Word of God, maybe you're struggling in some of these aspects that we looked at this evening, I would encourage you to come forward and we would be able to pray for you and with you. Won't you come to the front at this time while we stand and while we sing?